This episode of Beyond the Uniform is sponsored by Storybox. People trust each other more than they trust advertising. Storybox provides companies with the tools they need to take the best things their customers are saying and use these testimonials to drive more sales and referrals. You can find out if Storybox is right for you at StoryboxLite.com. If you employ a veteran, we'll also give you a 10% discount. That's StoryboxLite.com. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri.
For example, we had a $180 headphone that wasn't working, and it just wasn't the right price point, wasn't the right form factor. Once we stopped trying to win there, and we just focused on being great under $100, which was the first chapter of that story, it was amazing the power that focus can bring to the team. You know, not spreading yourself too thin, but guys, here's the one objective. Here's the one hill. Let's just focus here, because if we can win here, a lot of other things will just take care of themselves.
Well, I wanted to give you a couple quick reasons why I thought it was really valuable to hear Jason's stories today. First of all, he talks about turnaround work at companies, and this is ideally suited to a lot of veterans because it's rolling up your sleeves, getting your hands dirty, parachuting in to like that battalion unit that's not doing too well and helping them turn around. And he talks about what that's like and how that's helped him in his career and why it might be suitable to veterans listening. Second, he talks about taking the long view on one's career, of really developing a market expertise, really honing a skill, and setting yourself up for long-term success by not focusing on the short term, not getting too fixated on each individual job, but really focusing on what you can learn and really taking the time necessary to establish expertise that will benefit you in the long run. Third, he talks about the finance industry, his experience in banking, and how it's been so advantageous to him in his career of establishing a mental framework and a way to evaluate companies and understand the nuts and bolts of businesses and their strengths and weaknesses. So for those of you who are interested in finance or that skill set, he has a lot of great advice. And then lastly, you know, he is CEO of a company that was bought for $200 million while he was there in a leadership position. So he talks about general management, what it's like to be in the C-suite, that chief executive officer, chief financial officer, chief operations officer, all three of which are roles that he's held at the company. So for those of you interested in general management, I think Jason's got some great advice on cultivating that skill set. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find show notes, including links to everything we discuss, as well as other great resources for helping navigate your civilian career. One last thing, I wanted to thank two people, B. Randall and BJ Grizz, both of who gave great reviews on iTunes for the podcast. Very much appreciated. If you're listening, you haven't had a chance yet to give us a positive review on iTunes. That's a really helpful point in getting the word out about the show and getting this in front of more veterans. So with that, let's dive in to my interview with Jason Hodel. Well, joining me today in Salt Lake City, Utah, is Jason Hodel. Jason, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you very much.
So for listeners, I want to give you a quick background for Jason. This is very much abbreviated. He's got an extremely impressive bio, but he is currently the CEO of Skullcandy, which markets headphones, earphones, speakers, and other products. Skullcandy was founded in 2003 and acquired in October 2016 by Mill Road Capital for $200 million. Jason started out at West Point, after which he served as an infantry officer in the U.S. Army for 5 years. After the Army, he picked up his MBA at Wharton. He had an impressive career prior to Skullcandy. We'll get into a lot of that in our interview. And he joined the Skullcandy team initially as their CFO and COO, where he grew the company's revenue from $210 million to approximately $300 million. And after 3 years, he was appointed as the CEO of Skullcandy. So Jason, maybe to start things off, I'd love to maybe start with your decision when you left the Army to go and get your MBA. And I'm curious to learn about that decision and how vital you feel like that was in your career path.
Well, I think for me, it made all the difference. I really enjoyed my MBA experience. The school does really matter, and everybody who's listening probably knows that. I chose a school that was very finance focused, and at West Point I studied economics and had a real passion for finance and economics. So I just ate it up. I really loved it. There is no better way in my mind to transition from military life as an officer, especially, to a civilian job than grad school. And MBA, of course, is the business route. Different business schools have different types of strengths. You know, if you want to focus on marketing, Kellogg is famous for that. If you want to focus on entrepreneurship and startups and technology, Stanford's famous for that. They all have their different strengths. So try to align, if you're interested in an MBA, align your personal passions with the school, because that can really make a difference on the outcome, because the companies on the other side heavily recruit from the business schools that they think give them the best skill sets for their particular kind of business. My dream was to go be a mergers and acquisitions banker on Wall Street, and so I was completely obsessed with that, and so that was the path I chose. But like I said, I don't think there's any more efficient way to go and compete with our peers that are coming from other colleges that don't go into the military and catch up to them really quickly post MBA or grad school.
And as you think back to that initial transition from the Army into the civilian world, what was one of the biggest challenges you faced, and what advice do you have for those on active duty listening about how to anticipate that challenge?
For me, the biggest challenge was the vocabulary. It's just like the military. Whenever there's a million little acronyms that we use, and we all can speak that language and talk to each other, and civilians listen to us and they think we're crazy. The same thing goes for the civilian world. And so I all of a sudden was sitting next to classmates, and they had, you know, studied accounting undergrad. They had been in an investment bank or a private equity shop or a big consulting firm for 3, 4, 5 years. And they were just running full speed at just, let's just call it business, business talk. And so catching up and to them was a huge challenge. Like, this is a silly story, but the first time I heard someone say the word CapEx, which is a very common word in business, I had no idea that that was short for capital expenditures, you know, and so I was behind in the conversation, and I think it was a professor that was using it as he was explaining something around free cash flow. So something as simple as that, there's a lot of getting up to speed you have to do. Now, for me, I just put in the extra time and effort, like all of us do, being former military folks and studied, and you catch up. But I remember that was one of the biggest challenges I had.
Yeah, in the same way, I remember in my first quarter at business school, I thought investment bankers were like a teller at a bank. I had never even heard of the term. And it's just like, it's that same process that all of us went through in the military of learning those acronyms. And I like the way you say that, because it's like, look, you know, all of us learned this for the military. It was just a matter of practice and putting in the time. It's just the same process for the civilian sector on a lot of that terminology.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, I was torn when in preparing for the interview, because I really want to focus on your role at Skullcandy, because I think it's extremely impressive. But I also wanted to give room to hear your story of how you went from business school to be CEO of such an incredible brand. And, you know, I'd love to hear whatever you'd like to share with listeners about how you went from Wharton to that first initial role at Skullcandy.
Sure thing. So I came out of Wharton and was an investment banker at J.P. Morgan, and I did that until 2000, so a couple years. And but I figured out for myself that a lot of military people end up in the same place too. But I figured out that I just wanted to be, you know, in the front lines, in the trenches, with the people and the companies, creating the businesses and helping them grow, and figuring out how to make them better. And not be, you know, the person who kind of flies in at a very strategic level, but always stays at that kind of 10,000 foot level. It was much more to my personality and just what I enjoy doing. So I figured that out early in my career in 2000. And luckily, I didn't plan it this way, but I just kind of became this turnaround type executive where I seemingly always found these companies that were good companies but could be improved. And then you kind of parachute in and you do X, Y, and Z. It turns out well. And then because I was an M&A banker, I also understood the nuts and bolts of mergers and acquisitions. And most of these companies that I've worked with have been acquired and had liquidity events. And I didn't plan it that way. It just kind of fell into place. I think military folks like to roll up the sleeves, get the hands dirty. So I think we're kind of attracted to improving the unit that's not the best one in the battalion. You want to go in there and prove yourself that you can make a difference. And I think the same thing happens to us when we get in civilian life. So that's how it happened. The one piece of advice, strong advice, I'd give to all the listeners is really think, obviously, about the grad school you choose, because there's a brand there that gets attached to your name immediately, on the resume, and it's a differentiator. But also think really carefully about the first job you take out of graduate school, because immediately that's going to brand you as well. And you're going to start developing your own personal stock price. So for me, of course, that was JP Morgan. And, the JP Morgan alumni network has always been really valuable for me. And understanding the nuts and bolts of M&A from a high-end investment bank like JP Morgan has also really helped me. So I didn't realize how important that was going to be. But the opposite would be I have a lot of classmates that came out of Wharton, and this was 1998. And back then, this was the dot-com explosion. Everybody wanted to go to the dot-coms and build a new e-com business and attack all these markets. And we all know how that ended in the 2000s, but this was in the late 90s, it was all the rage. And I late at night talking to my friends, the ones that did that, I hear all the time them saying things like, geez, I thought the easier path was just to go to a big company like Microsoft and kind of slog away. But I really wish I'd done that, because that would have set up my career and my resume by, using the word I just used, branding me with the Microsoft brand rather than a startup brand, because a lot of those startup brands didn't survive. And so these are two big decisions that listeners will be making here, but I can't underscore the choosing very carefully that first company and take the long view. A lot of times you can go into a big company, slog away for a couple, 3, 4 years, and then you can go off and do things that are more entrepreneurial. But that's that first one's important.
I love that. I'm reminded of one of the business school professors I really liked was Joel Peterson. He's the chairman of the JetBlue Airlines board of directors. He had always said, "Look, you'll make your most money from age 40 to 50." And so everything in your career is just setting yourself up so that when you get to that point, you're just in your zone and you can crush it. And I love that thought of just, lily padding these jobs of, and as you said, taking that long view of not caring, about each individual step, but thinking of the skills you want to develop, the brand, the network that you want to develop so that you can get to somewhere eventually that you want to go, rather than trying to get there just immediately.
Yep. It's very easy when you leave the military to get really excited about a business model you learn about and you meet some people and it sounds just very thrilling. And we all can be victims of that. But as I look back, most of those companies that Wharton classmates jumped into, like I said, they're not around today. A lot of them had troubles, ran into financial distress. And so especially when you're ex-military, you got to be more careful, because you know what? All of those ideas and business models, they're going to be waiting for you on the other side of getting a good business education at a big company and getting grinded up a little bit like I did at JP Morgan. You work really hard, but it just pays so many dividends.
And I know that a lot of the listeners to the show have showed an interest in finance before. How would you explain, like, what was your life like at JP Morgan? Like, what were the hours like, and what sort of activities were you doing, and why might that be appealing to veterans?
The value of banking, especially for military folks, is that it's going to give you a mental framework from which to think about the value of companies that you'll never stop using until the day you leave the business world. You'll understand the nuts and bolts of finance and financial statements. You'll be able to very quickly assess the strength of the company, both balance sheet and income statement, and then you'll understand how what you're seeing there becomes a valuation in the public or private markets. You'll become an expert at that. And that framework in your mind, it's now that I've been in the business world away from banking, geez, for almost 20 years, I can tell you it's special. I used to think that everybody thought that way, and then eventually I figured out that, you know, not a lot of people did think that way. So it'll definitely set you apart.
And you know, you talked about going then into turnaround work, and I've always thought that's something that would be, like you had said, a really good fit for a lot of veterans, because I imagine you're going into situations where there's things going well in a company, things not going well, and being able to figure out how to change it. Just like you had said, like that the group in the battalion that's not performing as well. Could you maybe share a story of one of those companies that you worked with, and kind of like paint that picture of what it was like going in and trying to help them reach their next stage as a company?
Sure. I think military folks are really good in somewhat chaotic environments and creating order. That's one of the skills that it's in our DNA. And we're comfortable operating in chaos, frankly. And a lot of times in these turnaround companies and startups, it's chaotic. Startups are still figuring it out. And turnarounds, a lot of times the leadership team is changing over. And so you're starting from scratch and maybe picking up pieces that were dropped, and then you're going to hammer out new process and fix things. And military folks, that's just what we're trained to do. So I agree with you. It's pretty natural. I think the best story that can kind of show this. I was lucky enough when I left investment banking. Eventually, I landed at a company called Digex in Maryland. And it was a classic technology.com. The stock price had traded over $200 at one point. And I think the stock price was something like $1.50 when I showed up. And so just a massive, massive fall. And that leads to incredible morale problems because everybody's underwater and people worry about going out of business. And of course, the business was free cash flow negative. So people worried about distress. And so I stepped in, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, former infantry officer. And frankly, that framework that I talked about a moment ago that I learned through banking, at a high level, I simply applied that framework. I helped the president, her name's Rebecca. I just helped the management team apply that kind of a framework and helped them as a team. We built a new economic model. And, you know, fast forward, I think it was 2 years plus one quarter, we became free cash flow positive. We made a big deal of it in the quarterly earnings release because we were very proud. So that business was a data center web hosting business, and so massive capital expenditure requirements. So actually being free cash flow positive was a big deal. And eventually that we got bought by Verizon, and so there was a nice liquidity event. But really, you know, keeping the call at a high level here, we were taking that framework of what really creates true value and true free cash flow, and then really slicing and dicing the business by product, by business line. Of course, taking a look at where the labor was lined up against the value creation, and then making changes and being decisive.
And as you say this, I'm curious, you know, if someone listening is interested in this world, because I love this picture you've painted of how this finance background gives you such a great framework to understand that, like you said, the nuts and bolts of each business. So if someone listening is interested in this, is there any resources you would recommend, either books or programs or podcasts, anything that either has helped you learn about this or might be a good starting point for them to figure out what this world is like and if they want to do it?
Sure. I was surprised at how much is out there in the public domain. I was on Wharton's website, and these days you can actually check out the syllabus of a corporate finance class from the business schools and get a hold of the outlines and the textbooks. So if folks like what they're hearing, I would just go and grab the corporate finance curriculum and the textbooks at any one of the leading finance business schools and just check it out. They're all called corporate finance, you know, that's the introductory course, and just start there. And that'll lead you down this path.
That's great. I never even thought about that. And that is such an incredible resource, because you could, you know, obviously you're missing out on the instruction and you're missing out on the networking and a lot of things that go along with being in the class. But even just as a starting point to get a feel for the structure and some of those books and to dabble, that's such a great resource.
Yep.
So what was it that then led you to Skullcandy? How did that first opportunity arise?
Well, typically whenever I was going into these companies throughout my career, I was usually entering as a CFO or CFO/COO, depending on the company. And so I had a few experiences like that. And, you know, each company you go into, usually they get bigger and bigger as you get more experienced. And in this case, Skullcandy was looking for a CFO. And I was lucky enough to get introduced to the CEO at the time, and it was a public company. And I'd never been a public company CFO before. And so it was a big challenge. But like ex-military folks, that attracted me. You know, I wanted to do it and see what it was all like. Certainly, I'd been around the public markets as a banker and an investor. You know, so I'd been watching this for years and years, but never had been that guy on the microphone on the quarterly earnings call. So really, really attracted me. I joined in 4 years ago, and the company was unfortunately, you know, earnings negative. Revenues had fallen a good deal. And I wouldn't characterize Skullcandy as too much of a turnaround, though. It was a strong business. People loved the products. We just needed to, you know, make a few changes here and there. And I thank you for the nice intro, but if, you know, I did not drive the revenue increase at Skullcandy, that total team effort there, across the whole company. But, you know, since then we have ramped up revenues a good deal. And, in our kill zone, we call it, which is about $150 and down at retail, we are the domestic market leader in that kill zone. So it's been really exciting, but I joined as the CFO.
When you did join, what was your, I also think that operations is such a great functional role for a lot of veterans, and you had this nice balance between the chief operations officer and chief financial officer. What did your day-to-day life look like? What were some of the activities that you were doing, just to give people an understanding of what that sort of role looks like?
Yeah, it's really hard these days to become the COO in a business that you've never been in before and have incredible domain expertise. The reason I say that is I didn't join as COO at Skullcandy. I got my foot in the door by being a CFO. And so think great reporting, of course, telling the story of the company and the investment opportunity to investors, and helping, you know, being the CEO's eyes and ears for the finances of the business, and helping with all the budgeting and the resource allocation. But that's how I got my foot in the door. But I think it was about a year and a half into it, I was getting so involved in the operation, the day-to-day operations of the business. I just kind of grew into that other role, and then they were nice enough to give me the title eventually. But I would never have been able to get that job as COO right out of the box, because I'd never been in a headphone company before, you know. It's very difficult. So I guess the lesson learned for veterans is make sure you have one particular domain expertise that you truly are an expert at, and then you can use that to get into these great opportunities and companies, and then, you know, we're going to do a great job because that's what military folks do, and then you'll grow organically within the company.
I love that. I had interviewed Steve Reinemann. He's a Naval Academy graduate who became the CEO of Pepsi, and he had similar advice on, he calls it like a hip pocket skill. And I love this advice you're giving, which it sounds like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, it's almost like once you get out of the military, it's really investing and developing one skill that you're really good at. And that could be you really understand the headphone space, or maybe you really understand, you know, grocery store supply, or maybe you really understand finance, just developing a very specific skill. And once you build up that, you know, actually, I interviewed the author Cal Newport for one of the podcasts, and he has a book called So Good You Can't Ignore, So Good They Can't Ignore You. And he talks about it in terms of, he calls it, capital, career capital, where if you build up career capital and expertise, you can really trade that to get better and better roles, or higher paying roles, or more interesting jobs. So I love that thought of really picking and defining that. And like you said before, taking that long term in your career of investing in that skill set.
Exactly.
And then, you know, you talked about this team effort of this, you know, the dramatic growth that the company achieved when you were in the role as COO and CFO. Any stories you'd like to share about that, of how that growth came about, or how you started to learn about this industry and where to really improve?
Well, whenever we grew the revenue base, like you said, it was about $210 million in 2013. And we've grown significantly from there. I think the most important thing that drove our strategy there was focus. We were trying to create too many products and too many price points in too many different channels and too many SKUs. It was just like some of the business reality shows that we see on TV these days. And we had to just sit down and figure out, okay, what are those 100 SKUs that are really important, where we really make our money, where we really get the peg velocity that retailers want to see and it's really important to them. And everything I just said, it might sound easy, but it's not. It takes a lot of work to look at hundreds and hundreds of those and narrow it down to just the ones that really move the needle. And then, but once you do that and you stop, for example, we had a $180 headphone that wasn't working, and it just wasn't the right price point, wasn't the right form factor. Once we stopped trying to win there and we just focused on being great under $100, which was the first chapter of that story, it was amazing the power that focus can bring to the team. So, you know, not spreading yourself too thin, but guys, here's the one objective. Here's the one hill. Let's just focus here, because if we can win here, then it's very profitable, but a lot of other things will just take care of themselves.
Man, that's such great advice. I love that laser focus. And I can only imagine when you've got so many opportunities as a company and all of them are generating some amount of revenue, I can only imagine the discipline it takes to do the analysis and then just really put a stake in the ground and say, look, we could make money in a lot of ways, but this is the one we're going to focus on. And I can imagine that it can be so incredibly distracting to have too many objectives, but when you're able to distill that down to the team, you get everyone pushing in the same direction. You get everyone going for the same goal. And I imagine that's extremely difficult to pick that one thing, but I can also imagine how much momentum that brings to your team when you do that.
Exactly. And then you stop all the wasted motion on things that aren't going to win anyway. and you reallocate that over to things that move the needle. And that's when the magic starts happening.
That's awesome. And I'd love to learn about your, the transition to becoming CEO, but also what that role is like. And I imagine for many veterans, I imagine that they spike in areas of leadership. I imagine that many people listening aspire to be that commanding officer role in the business of running the show. And so I'd love to just have you share what your experience has been like, what some of the things, like what your day might look like, and how you manage all of that.
Well, it's not as glamorous as one might think. Obviously, it comes with its fair amount of stress and just responsibility. And so the mantle of leadership that military folks are trained for and we're comfortable with, it's just truly a mantle in a business like this because, we had to do some layoffs. Almost always there's some of that in turnarounds. And that is emotionally taxing. It's extremely hard. And military folks, we generally care more about the people and the troops, going back to an analogy there, than the rest. So we really take these things to heart. So it's not easy, obviously. And it doesn't seem like a big deal to me. I just come to work like all of us do. I think driving things day to day, the most important thing, really, that I have to make sure that I'm doing a good job of is making sure people understand the priorities and people don't get off track. It goes back to the focus comment. It's remarkable how quickly a company or a group or people can become distracted and get off track. And so that's kind of number one. And then number two is you got to make sure all the communication is going on the way it should. Certain groups are working together the right way. And so that whenever you have a work product, say something as simple as, okay, here's what the new product is going to look like, that all of the people that need to have a say in that and do their homework, that's happened. So getting the organization working cross-functionally together, and priorities, I mean, those are the biggest things that a CEO has to do well.
I'm wondering with I'm just picturing what your life must be like. How do you continue to grow as a CEO? Like you're now at a point where I guess you've got your board, but you've got no one giving you feedback or critiquing you. I'm imagining the people that work for you, it's hard to kind of get objective feedback from them. When you're in that pinnacle role, how are you getting mentorship or how are you getting honest feedback on where you need to grow and how have you approached that continued growth, as a CEO?
I think the truth is, for folks like us, the biggest feedback you get is when you look yourself in the mirror and the thinking you're doing at night when you can't sleep. And because when you're tuned into your company and the people in it, and the wins and the losses from a business perspective become very obvious, just because, market share and sell through and how things work out. So it won't be hard to figure out the challenges of the business. The hard part is figuring out what to do about it. And nobody's going to be as honest to ourselves as we are to ourselves. Like in the military, nobody's going to beat up Justin more than Justin. That's how we're wired. And so most of that is going on between the ears. Now, the board absolutely gives feedback to the company and to me. That's their role. That's their job. They're the owners. And you got to take that super seriously. I think the biggest place where I always have to continue to do hard work is market mastery. And what I mean by that is knowing every product that's out there, every customer, every competitor. What are the competitors doing? Are they changing prices? What's going on in the digital world versus, the retail shelves? That ecosystem that I just described, it changes every day. And you got to stay on top of your game. And then when you go and you meet with your customers and you're talking to them, it makes those meetings so much more valuable because you have lots of interesting things to talk about, what you're seeing in the business. you know, it just doesn't become a handshake and a you know, and a smile. You're actually talking about real business issues. But that market mastery, that's never ending, and it's super hard.
I just love that image, especially for a veteran, where it's like you're the one who's evaluating your own performance, and you're the one who has to be able to critique how you're doing and push yourself further. And I think that's just incredible. I imagine how challenging that must be, but also I imagine how fulfilling that must be to feel like you're really at your edge and you're really growing. I'm also curious, you know, maybe for someone who's on active duty listening, who aspires to be CEO, I'm kind of trying to figure out for them what are the gaps they need to fill from their military skill set to be able to effectively run a company. And it sounds like one of those that you did was around finance, but I'm just curious any thoughts you have on from active duty to being the CEO of a company, what sort of skill sets does someone need to acquire along the way to do that job effectively?
Well, I think it's there's no doubt in my mind it's the market mastery piece. So there's another fellow, Jason Crabtree, who's a West Point grad, and he runs a company called Fractal. And listening to him talk about his market, I heard him give his pitch recently, and I walked away and I was like, I need to raise my game. It was so impressive, and he's only been out of the military for, you know, 3, 4 years, not 20 years like me. And so it motivated me to get better at market mastery. But the reason, if you really want to run the show, you got to know that cold. But then what you need to do is you need to tie the business opportunities that you see, you know, through your vision, to here's the way we're going to attack that market, with a product or a strategy or a new technology. But here's the way we're going to attack that market. Here's how much it's going to cost us. Here's how we're going to create profits. But tying that all together, but starting from a place of market mastery is super hard. But that is, in my mind, that is what the core of the CEO job is.
And that makes me think back to it sounds like, you know, being at West Point, you had this interest in finance, and it sounds like you kind of knew that in the military, which brought you to Wharton, and then you pursued finance after that. Do you have any thoughts for someone, again, who might be maybe on active duty right now listening, and they buy into what you're saying about this market focus? Do you have any advice on how they might start to figure out what market they'd like to be in or what market to pursue after the military?
I think you already know, you just don't know, you know. And what I mean by that is I've always enjoyed music. You know, it's always been a big part of my life. And so for me, ending up in an audio company where our branding is the majority of it is done through music, I don't think that happens by coincidence. I think you just are drawn, you know, to those sorts of things. My son wants to go study, you know, cyber security, and you know, he's heard about the Academy program, and he's super interested in that. But he's also that kid, I'm sure, like all of them, he likes to play video games. So he definitely wants to do something around technology, computers, IT, and that's naturally kind of drawn him towards the cyber world. So I think you just have to, you know, kind of look yourself in the mirror and think, well, geez, if I have to get up for 5 years every morning, go to this company and have market mastery, what market's going to be interesting to me? You know, earlier in my career, for a while, I was in the sports world, and it was another turnaround. But it's not an accident that, you know, the sport that I was helping to turn around was the one I'd been an athlete in for years. And so these things happen for a reason. And if you can align your the job you're working for and the turnaround perhaps that you're working on with a product that gets you up in the morning anyway, that is when, like I said before, that's when the magic's going to happen.
I love that thought that they already know it. They just don't know they know it. It's a matter of kind of uncovering what that is, what that deeper passion is, or that deeper interest is.
There's a great book that when I was at Wharton, I was thinking the same things. and it's called What Color Is Your Parachute? And I remember looking through that book, and that one helped me a lot. So that I'd throw that one out.
Awesome. And for listeners, I'll add all these in the show notes at beyondtheuniform.io. I'll have links to the books and the syllabus and things like that. One thing I was thinking of as we were talking, Jason, is, and I don't know if this is true, but I'm guessing that over your last, 20 years or so, you have interviewed and maybe hired other veterans. And I'm just wondering if anything stands out to you as like a common mistake that veterans might make when they're applying to a job or where they're interviewing, or I'm kind of going on a limb that maybe there might be something like that that you've seen. But does anything stand out to you that you'd want to share with listeners?
Sometimes military folks, and I was guilty of this, we think that the civilian's going to know exactly what a company executive officer in the 25th Infantry Battalion does, or a company commander, or a platoon leader. And it takes a lot of work to help civilian people understand the breadth of the responsibility and the day-to-day grind that we've all lived. So you have to really work at that. And then, so that's part A. And then part B is, because we're so proud of our service and what we've done, I think sometimes we assume that the civilian folks are going to be blown away by it and they're going to want to hire us immediately. But I have to tell you that a lot of times the civilians, not only do they not understand it, which is goes back to part A and how we have to explain it, but then part B is don't assume that the civilian's going to think that it's super important and make a lot out of it. You really have to get on with the other part of the interview, which is show your market mastery of of their market, of course. But then here's how Justin can show up day one, and here are the three ideas that I would have as your new senior director of operations that I've seen at your warehouse or in store. This is how I'd fix it. And here are five examples how your competitors have already fixed it. And here's what I think it'll cost. And by doing this, you'll sell this much more of your product. And this is, give them a vision of exactly how day one you'll hit the ground running, and you're going to help them improve their business and make more money. But if you forget to do part C there and you just focus on A and B, it's just not enough. It's too competitive out there. It really is. But if you do A and B really well, explain what you did in the military. Don't assume they're going to think it's great, but then show them how you can help them make money using the discipline and the frameworks. That's whenever you'll set yourself apart from the civilians that you're competing with, and the military will become an advantage.
I think that's such great advice, and I think that is something that's come through in a lot of the last, 120 interviews that I've done, is that I think our modern military, we have this mantra, and I definitely heard this a lot and felt this a lot, where it's that, we are serving our country and the country owes us something. And then when you leave the military, you have this expectation that that's going to be enough. And I think that puts our veterans at a disadvantage, because what I'm hearing from you is like, that not everyone who is hiring you might have the same level of appreciation or knowledge of what you've done, and you can't rely solely on that. You need to go further, and you need to, show them what you're going to do for them, and do that extra homework. I love that example you'd given of like, hey, this is what your competition is doing. This is what I would do. This is like giving them that vision of how you from day one are going to contribute to their organization. And so I think that's really quality advice, and I think that's consistent with some of the other things I've heard on these interviews.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm wondering, You know, I actually, I'm cognizant of the, we're towards the end of our time. I always like to make room at the end of the interview just for like final words of wisdom and just recognize, and I've asked a lot of questions I thought would be helpful for listeners, but Jason, I also know that you've been so active with the veteran community of talking to different people throughout your career and giving them advice. So I'd love to just maybe turn it over to you for the final minutes here to just share anything else you would want listeners to know or any final advice you have for them.
Sure. The most important thing I think I could pass on, I got some great advice from a Wharton classmate in 1997. They had this program where people that had had a job in the industry that you're trying to get to interview their classmates as if the person's interviewing, for the job. And then you get real-time feedback from someone who's kind of in it was from a company you want to get into. So of course I was being interviewed by a former investment banker. And two things that I can to this day I can see it in my mind. The first thing he kind of said was, it goes back to my part A of you got to explain this military stuff better. Ranger school. People kind of hear that, but what goes on there? And so he had me add more color to my resume. And in fact, he coined this one sentence I put in my resume, and I think it was next to platoon leader or something like this. But basically, the sentence was something like, responsible for the lives and welfare of 30 infantry soldiers, something as simple as that. But he's like, hey, you have no idea. When a banker reads that, they're gonna be like, oh, this sounds cool. I want to learn more. Talk more about Ranger School in here. And so he kind of knew some of the attention getters that could take the military piece and turn it into a positive. And the other piece of advice he gave me, and I'd really, really ask the listeners to think about this one, is he said, the interview, it's not about being humble. Okay? Military folks come out, and we have been beat down throughout our career to respect authority, respect higher ranking officers, to be humble. And all of these things are wonderful attributes and are part of the military ethos. The civilian world is not like that. And when you're in an interview situation, you got to keep telling yourself, this is not about being humble. And it's not about coming out of your shoes either, but there's a healthy balance there, and you got to find that balance. But his clear feedback to me was that, I was just being too humble. And I think that's another thing that's kind of common in the DNA of military folks, especially as soon as they get close to the civilian world, and they're kind of thinking in their heart, and they're just kind of like, man, I've not been in a business for one day one. How am I going to go interview? I have so much to learn. And we can kind of get in our own head and beat ourselves up about that. But when it comes interview time, come out of your shoes about your academic record and military, but find that balance, and then you can flip it and then impress them with the market mastery that you've gotten up to speed with and the business ideas you have for them. But don't be shy, it's just one way to sum it up.
I think that's such great advice, and I think that's something I've heard before, and I love the way you put that of just not recognizing that because of their military background, they're probably going to be more humble, more soft-spoken, and less likely to talk about their experiences. And it's almost like knowing your knowing that if you seem boastful, if you feel like you're boasting, that's probably middle of the road. It's like recognize that we're so far to one side that you're gonna have to feel a little bit uncomfortable in those interview situations. It will probably feel like you're being cocky, and most veterans, cocky is gonna actually be still a little bit
Normal.
soft, yeah, normal or maybe even soft spoken. And
One advice I'd give is write out the answers to the questions you're going to get. If you brainstorm and do some research, you can probably, come up with 20 questions, and in every interview you'll get 15 of them. Write out your answers or at least outline them, so that you can work in naturally, the data and your background. Practice it in front of a mirror so you get good at it, and it'll sound natural. And never, ever say sir or ma'am in a civilian interview. Just don't do it. I made that mistake. I think it frankly makes people feel uncomfortable a little bit because it's so different. And it's really hard, especially for the folks that are transitioning directly from the military and they're meeting the CEO and the guy's, 45, 50 years old. And it's hard sometimes not to say sir or ma'am because that's the way we've been trained, but don't do it.
Yeah, it's almost like that's an indication that the person who says that hasn't made the transition yet. Like they're not in their new. It's like you're completely out of your element, and it's like a red flag that like this person is not. I'm gonna have to now train this person not to do that. And it goes back to your thought on painting that picture of exactly how you're gonna add value, and like you don't want to be a liability, the person where you have to break all of these old habits that are not gonna benefit you in the civilian sector.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, Jason, I appreciate your time. I appreciate your advice. And for listeners in the show notes, I'll have links to everything we discussed and links to Skullcandy where you can learn more about Jason and the work that he's doing. And yeah, thank you so much for sharing your perspective with the audience today.
You're welcome, and good luck to everybody out there. Surface, surface, surface.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview with Jason. Check out Skullcandy. It's a really cool company. They've got awesome products and led, as you've heard, by an incredible veteran. Couple last things. If you haven't had a chance to leave a positive review on iTunes, would greatly appreciate it. Again, a shout out to B. Randall and BJ Grizz for doing so. Really, really appreciate it. Second of all, if you haven't yet signed up for our newsletter, if you go to beyondtheuniform.io/newsletter, you can just input your email address. We'll keep you updated on everything going on. And then lastly, I wanted to just give a plug for a couple organizations. No official relationship with them, but Service to School and American Corporate Partners. Service to School is a free resource for veterans. They help you if you're applying to grad school, undergrad, med school, whatever it is, they help you figure out what you need to do to get involved there. American Corporate Partners associates veterans with mentors in the civilian sector. Both are absolutely free for veterans. If I was making the transition today, I would definitely check them out. So that's all for this week, and I'll be back next week with more interviews with veterans about their civilian career. Take care.